Spring advice for Maine gardeners from two gardening experts. It's May Day, and boy, does the forecast look nice for tomorrow and Thursday. It's going to be the kind of weather that just may lure you outside into the garden. As you clean up those twigs and leaves, are you also thinking about trying a new perennial or different vegetables this year? Maybe you've already planted the peas and some cool weather greens, or is this the year you are determined to green up the bald spots in your lawn? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we have two gardening experts here to answer your early season questions. Bill Kalina, director of the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, and Pamela Hargest, a horticultural professional with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. What do you want to know to make your garden grow? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Springtime is slowly making its way to Maine, and we are seeing some daffodils and tulips peeking out. Maybe you've even gotten started with your vegetable garden, or maybe you don't know where to begin. Today's guests have plenty of tips and advice for all of your gardening needs. Joining me in our studio, we welcome back Bill Kalina, President and CEO of Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. Also with us today, Pamela Hargest, a horticultural professional with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension in Cumberland County. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have questions about soil quality, pest control, planting seedlings? No question is too dumb. Give us a call. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Here we are on May Day. I want to start by asking you, Bill, what does the first day of May mean to you?
Oh, just utter happiness. It's been a long winter.
Yeah. So what's going on at Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens on May Day? You're open, right?
We're open. Yeah. We opened a couple weeks ago, and we just started using our new visitor center the other day, which is really exciting. So I've been spending the last couple of days building a hoop house that we're going to cover with netting, and we're going to have hundreds and hundreds of native butterflies in there starting in June. So that's going to be really fun. But right now we're focused on the spring bulbs, all the and the wildflowers, everything starting to come into flower. I think this weekend's supposed to be nice. It should really pop the color in the gardens.
Yeah, it's supposed to be warm. What about you, Pamela? What does May 1st mean to you?
Well, right now our master gardeners are very busy. The season's starting to plant things in our gardens, and we have our master gardener plant sale coming up. But generally, I mean, for me personally, I get excited about the vegetables that are going to be coming out in the garden, especially fresh arugula and turnips and all that really good stuff.
All right. So I'm going to ask you this, Pam. Pamela, I looked at the long-range forecast last weekend and decided to go ahead and plant most of my vegetable garden. You think I'll be okay?
Yeah, well, it depends on what it is. I would say definitely the cold, hardy stuff, you can go ahead and get started. Direct seeding your salad mix, your turnips, radishes. If you want to put out transplants for cabbage, cauliflower, all that stuff, it's definitely good to go. Might want to hold off on some of those heat-loving vegetables, though.
Hold off on the tomatoes?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'll hold off. I won't go buy tomatoes at the farmer's market this weekend yet. Tomato seedlings. Mm-hmm. Bill, congratulations. I have the Booth Bay Register in front of me. The American Horticultural Society, pleased to announce William Kalina has been named the 2018 recipient of the Society's Professional Award. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. That
was it a surprise?
It was a surprise. I mean, I'd known about it for a little while, but I was very surprised and honored and looking forward to going down there in June.
That's terrific. That's terrific. That's great. And I'm so glad that I did some research on the internet before you came in today.
You're good, Jennifer.
Pamela, do you run? You mentioned the Master Gardener program. Mm-hmm. This is the program that you're involved with. I think a lot of people have heard of the Master Gardener program, but aren't sure what it entails. If somebody goes through that, are they indeed an expert?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a learning process. There's always something to learn in gardening or vegetable world. But it's a really great program. You go through training with University of Maine specialists and individuals from the Maine government and other specialists in the state. So you go through like a 15-week program and then you become a volunteer. And so you're really able to reach out to your community and give back a little bit.
How does somebody apply for the Master Gardener program?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this program is in every county throughout the state. In Cumberland County, we usually start accepting applications in the fall. So if someone's interested in the program, you can reach out to us at our office and we can go ahead and add you to our interest list. But then the training program usually starts at the end of January, beginning of February.
And those who are accepted and complete the program, there's a community service element, correct?
Yes, that's correct. So for the first year after the training, you're required to volunteer for 40 hours. And then once you go through that and you become a certified master gardener, you then volunteer only 20 hours a year.
Okay. And what kind of projects have you seen master gardeners take on as their volunteer projects?
So many. So there's a lot of master gardeners involved with community gardens. And we have a lot of people who will grow vegetables for our Maine Harvest for Hunger program. There's gleaning efforts. There's educational opportunities, people who are just interested in teaching classes. So it really can be anything that you want it to be as long as it's garden related and giving back in some way.
All right. Before we get to the calls, I want to ask you all about this particular season, Bill, that we had that really, really, really cold snap at the end of December, beginning of January. And then it's been a pretty wet spring. How is this? What is the impact of that on people's gardens? What can they expect to see this spring and expect to be dealing with?
It's always a little challenging when it goes from being not too cold to really cold very fast, because plants that are winter hardy take a while to become winter hardy during the wintertime. So I would expect, the more tender woody plants, the things like hydrangeas and stuff like that, will get pretty, hit pretty hard this year. But my rule of thumb with that stuff is just let it wait another couple of weeks, see what comes back before you start ripping things out. Because a lot of times, even if the plant was damaged in the winter, it'll come back from the roots or come back from lower down. The wetness makes it a little bit harder to work the soil this time of year. You don't really want to work the soil and get in there and plant if it's really boggy, because you can destroy the structure. So it makes it a little difficult sometimes to get out into the garden.
And does this wet spring affect vegetable gardeners?
Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, it can make it harder to get out into the garden. That does make it's easier for home gardeners versus farmers who rely on tractors and more equipment. But generally, I mean, wet springs are great because it means we have a good water supply for the summer, and just in case we do have a very hot, dry spell that comes through.
All right. Well, I'm going to start with an email that came in this morning. This is from Bill in Bangor. He writes, "Hi, we live in Bangor, have reseeded our pathetic lawn the last two springs. Both times grass grew well through July, then died and has no roots. Fall raking left large areas of bare dirt. We'd like to avoid pesticide treatments, etc. Some neighbors talk of grubs. Thinking of turning the yard into a meadow with wildflowers. Suggestions?"
Sounds like my yard. No.
Oh, don't say that, Bill.
It's hard to know sun shade wise, but assuming that this is a pretty sunny lawn, it does sound like the soil is a problem. And there's things you can do to try to bring to get the roots down into the soil. Grubs are pretty obvious. If you do have grubs, it's usually Japanese beetles and a few of those other beetles. And when you peel back the sod, you'll see all these little white grubs, right? In the roots. And so you can see if you've got those. It's amazing what you can do if it's not too big of an area to rake compost into your lawn this time of year, just about an inch or so at the most, rake it through. You can rent something called a core aerator, which is this machine that like a big sort of a lawnmower type thing, and it takes plugs out of the lawn, and then you can rake the compost in and try to get the to open up the soil. I would try that first, try to rent a core aerator and then rake compost in and see if that helps build the soil structure so the grass can grow better.
So it's the compacted soil without many nutrients that's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, the grubs often are more of a symptom than a cause. I mean, in the areas where Japanese beetles are really moving north, they come in like a wave. We've had a lot of Japanese beetle questions on here during the summertime, but I would first look at the soil and see if you can improve the soil, and then and that may cure the problem.
All right. We'll go to Adam calling from Westbrook. Hi, Adam. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm wondering if you can help me resolve a little debate between my wife and I. I put most of my seedlings in the garden on Friday. Today is Tuesday, including tomatoes about 4 inches tall. They had a fine dusting of frost on them. I'm wondering, was it a mistake or not?
Well, you're wondering if they'll make it. What do you think? Will they make it?
Well, I think it is definitely a little too early for tomatoes. We usually say waiting until the end of May, May 25th, around Memorial Day is always a good rule of thumb, just because there's still a chance of frost. And as those seedlings are still small, they're more susceptible to damage from frost.
Now that he's got them in the ground, would you recommend watching the forecast if it's going to get cold at night, putting a little sheet over them or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say if you already have them out there, make it an experiment. You could also use something like a milk jug or something as like kind of a hot cap for your tomato and just see what happens there. If you take the cap off the jug, you know, cut the bottom, put it over your tomato plant, it'll give it a little bit of airflow going in so it won't get too hot on warm days. But might as well try something like that if it's already out there.
Good luck, Adam. Tomatoes are so tough in Maine, aren't they? I mean, we all want great tomatoes. They sort of mean summertime, but they're my toughest.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're heat lovers, so it's difficult to grow them and get a good full season crop from your tomatoes unless you have a hoop house or something.
We'll go to Tom, who is calling from Newfield. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Hey, a quick question. I was just curious. We've been gardening pretty heavy for a number of years, and we have pest problems like any garden does. And I'm just wondering, is there any advantage if you were to not plant vegetables for a year? Would a lot of them move on, or it would make no difference?
It 1 year might not be enough, Tom. But, I mean, you probably heard of the concept of crop rotation. And the idea with that is it's an age-old practice of basically not growing the same thing in the same soil year after year. Corn and soybeans, they rotate, but I found 1 year usually isn't enough. It takes a couple of years to not do it. But eventually some of the pests will move on. But if you do have a large enough area where you can at least rotate the different types of plants, like the tomatoes and the peppers and eggplants in one part of the garden 1 year, the legumes in one part of the garden and switch it up, that can help somewhat on the soil diseases, if nothing else.
Yeah, and I would just add to that, it never hurts to stop growing whatever you're growing, vegetables or whatnot, and just throw down some cover crop just to try to bring back some of the soil health and give it a little rest.
What do you recommend for a cover crop in Newfield?
Well, buckwheat makes a really good summer cover crop. There's a lot of good winter cover crops as well. You could do a legume like peas, or you could do some type of winter rye or annual ryegrass. Sometimes doing a blend helps too.
All right. Well, good luck to you, Tom. We're going to go to Bath and Katrina. Hi, Katrina. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I have a quick question about peonies, planting peonies. Now, on the internet, I've done a lot of research, and everything keeps telling me that you must plant them in the fall. But the people at our local nursery told me that they are in, and I can plant them anytime. So I'm just wondering when the best time to plant them for the first time would be.
Well, Katrina, it kind of depends on if they're bare root plants or if they're in pots. And most of what you have in the nurseries are going to be potted peonies. So those are fine. Yeah, so those are fine to plant in the spring. That rule of thumb came about when they sold peonies more like roses, bare root, and you put the tree peonies in the spring and then the the standard peonies in the fall. But potted ones, we plant them any time during the spring or fall, and they do fine. So
great. I love peonies. Okay. Good luck, Katrina. Thank you. An email from Mike in Cape Elizabeth. I noticed we've got moles. Is this year worse than others for moles? And if you do have moles, is this a bad sign that your lawn may be infested with grubs or some other vermin?
Want me to take this one?
I'll let you go first.
She's giving me the look. The thing is to determine if they're moles or not. If it's the shallow tunnels that look like they've just kind of grazed through the top of the grass and made indentations, that's usually voles, which feed during the wintertime on the lawn. They're eating the grass itself, and they'll leave, you know, traces where the grass has all been eaten and that sort of thing. The moles are obviously down underneath, and they are looking for grubs and other things in the lawn. So yeah, if you do have moles in there, then there's something for them to be feeding on. I find that they, you know, typically when I've had mole situations, they'll come in and they'll feed for a while, then they'll move on to something else. So I don't worry about the moles as much as the voles, which can be so destructive to the grass itself.
All right. And I'm going to add to that before you chime in, Pamela. Jonathan on Facebook says, what's the best way to get rid of grubs? Something's digging up my yard, eating them, and I need to get rid of the grubs before I start repairing the grass.
Yeah, so I've been getting this question a lot this spring, people calling in about grubs. And, first make sure they are grubs, as it sounds like it probably is. We usually say for a square foot, if you can find 8 grubs, and that's usually the threshold or when there is an infestation, that's a problem. So there's a lot of different options with grubs, but unfortunately, if you live in an area where grubs are a problem, then it'll probably continue to be a problem. So sometimes looking at the long-term options, you know, more diversity than just a lawn, looking to plant some other things, looking to plant something like clover that might have a deeper root system. Those are some things to consider long-term, but one thing that is not really a pesticide to use, but a biological control is you could use beneficial nematodes, which would be released in your lawn towards the end of August. And that's another good option to avoid using something that could be harmful.
Where does one purchase beneficial nematodes?
So some local greenhouses will sell them. I know Skillins, Fedco, O'Donnell's, those just to name a few, but you can order them online as well, but I think getting a local source is probably the best way to go.
All right. Yeah, always a lot of questions this time of year about this subject. We're going to go to Elizabeth in Mechanic Falls. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a lot of pine trees on the edge of what was my parents' property, and it hasn't been taken care of properly. So I have a giant patch of dirt. And 2 young children. I put up some swings in one of the trees, and I really want something. It doesn't have to be grass, but something besides the dirt under there for them to play. Any solutions? I've tried for the past 2 years to put down seed and dig up the dirt. It's really rocky.
So, Elizabeth, is it rocky and shady there?
It's mostly like shady for about half the day. The other half the day, it's pretty sunny. So,
all right. Suggestions?
Well, it's certainly a tough place to grow grass. I mean, you wouldn't want to do just sort of, you know, wood mulch or something like that, Elizabeth. I mean, that some grades of that stuff is easier, you know, easier for them to plant. It's not like playing on a lawn. One thing you could do if you have an arborist that you know of, and they can come and limb up the pine trees, unless they're really acting as a screen or something for you. But if they go and cut the lower limbs off, not just the dead ones, but limb up some of the live ones to let more light in there, it also eliminates some of the competition with the grass. And you can actually bring in soil to, as long as you don't pile it up around the pine tree's trunk. You know, you can put 6 inches or so of soil as long as you keep it away from the trunk and try to build up a little more and attempt grass again. But there isn't a lot else that you could grow that would be a substitute for turf that would be something playable. You know, there's lots of plants that would grow underneath there, but they wouldn't stand the foot traffic that I can think of, really.
Elizabeth, good luck, and thanks for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does DeMont Associates, philanthropic advisors helping Maine and New England nonprofits raise capital for 25 years. DeMontAssociates.com.
On the next Fresh Air, comic Michelle Wolfe. We'll talk about her performance Saturday night at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which became controversial because of jokes like this one about Sarah Sanders.
I actually really like Sarah. I think she's very resourceful. Like, she burns facts, and then she uses that act to create a perfect smoky eye.
Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. Public radio is an easy choice for many of you. Our world is constantly changing, evolving, and it's important for us to stay on top of what's going on. Maine Public Radio does that day in and day out, and it does it in a way so many of us value because listener support makes it possible. Your support. We have a one-day and one-day-only membership campaign coming on Super Thursday, May 10th. Please pledge your support, any amount, as a brand-new contributor, a rejoining member, or by increasing your pledge. You can take that step right now, if it's more convenient, online at mainepublic.org. Thanks for doing your part.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are answering your gardening questions. The experts with me today, Pamela Hargest, who is horticulturist with UMaine Cooperative Extension in Cumberland County, and Bill Kalina, president and CEO of Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll go to Julie in Freeport. Hi, Julie. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I have a question about groundhogs. We are about to plant a vegetable garden for the first time in a long time, and I know for a fact that we have groundhogs in this area. So what should we do?
Groundhogs love vegetable gardens, don't they, Pamela?
No, friends of mine feed the groundhogs. So.
They feed the groundhog.
Well, they are cute, but Pamela was gasping. Go ahead.
So I've dealt with groundhogs myself in the past, and for vegetable gardens, I would recommend doing an L-shaped fence around your vegetable garden. It doesn't have to be very high. It only has to be, I think it's usually 3 feet high, maybe 4 feet, a chicken wire fence. And then what you do is you put some fencing underground in an L shape, and it essentially tricks the groundhogs. They'll go to dig under the fence, and then they hit this L shaped fence that can go out. I think you could probably just make it go out 2 feet, and that would be enough. But you, of course, want to bury it again. But that, for me, has worked wonderful and in the past, and definitely a way to not use any chemical agents or do anything too crazy.
Yeah, I remember I had a friend, a groundhog family, wiped out his entire vegetable garden overnight. Bill, you're nodding.
I lived in a house one time, and we were the only house that didn't have a dog. And all the groundhogs in the neighborhood came to our house. And it was just, I gave up trying to grow a vegetable garden there. It was too much, too sad.
You have a dog now, right?
We don't have a dog now.
Oh, no.
I haven't seen any groundhogs around, though. So yeah. Maybe Julie could tell her neighbors to feed them more so they're satisfied, so then they won't come over and bother her.
That's a good idea.
Good luck,
I guess it's illegal to feed wildlife.
Anyway. We'll go to Tig, who's calling from Cumberland. Hi, Tig. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. Wow, it seems like we're all calling about pests, but I am here to ask about deer. Two kind of questions. First, do you have any recommendations for plants, either perennials or annuals, that we could plant this year that deer typically kind of stay away from? And then secondly, for those plants that are like deer candy, which are already planted, like hostas or whatever, any advice for how to keep them away or anything, any tricks up your sleeve?
I wish there was a magic bullet with deer. I mean, the only sure way is to, you know, exclude them with fencing. But there are lots of lists if you go online of deer resistant or deer deer-proof plants. I've never met a deer-proof plant, but there's certainly lots of perennials, especially that the deer like to eat less. You know, they tend to be things that are more poisonous. You know, so you hear daffodils versus tulips, or hellebores versus hostas, like those kind of things that the deer kind of avoid. There are the sprays that you can put on. Again, like, different deer have different tastes, but if you try some of these repellents, they do discourage them somewhat, especially like if you've, we put them on the tulips when they're coming in the flower, so you can enjoy the flowers, and, you know, then after if they eat it, it wears off after a rain, so you have to reapply. But it's, you know, the sprays are good as a short-term thing, so you can enjoy flowers and that sort of thing. But.
And a fence around a vegetable garden has to be pretty high to keep the deer out, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, because deer can jump pretty high over the fence. So like 8 or 9 feet?
I'm trying a new type this year, which is really easy. So I took 4 big stakes, put them at the corners, and I'm stretching 30-pound monofilament, clear monofilament, about 18 inches from the ground up all around it. And they can't, supposedly 30-pound, they can't see, but they back into it, or they hit it, and it scares them, and they move away. And so I'll report back how that works.
Okay, that'll be great. Thank you, Tig. An email from Robin. I'd like to plant a fast-growing vine on a trellis to provide some privacy for my backyard. What would you recommend? Evergreen vines other than ivy are of interest as well.
That's tough. There aren't a lot of evergreen vines, really, that that are fast-growing that can survive in Maine. There's certainly lots of fast-growing vines that you could think about. They're not going to be evergreen. Things like the wild clematis, that's a nice one. The trumpet honeysuckle. Wisteria certainly grows fast. I would use the North American wisterias, not the Chinese one, because that really can get out of hand. Those are all pretty good. An old-fashioned screening plant that everybody used to plant all the time is something called Dutchman's pipe, with the big heart-shaped leaves, a very, very dense screen that people used to plant on their porches to shade. And then there are annual things like morning glories and stuff like that you can use during the summertime.
An email from Lynn. I've had recurring problems with blight. Never sure whether it's early blight or late blight. I rotate my tomatoes with green beans, but the small size of my garden makes it hard to avoid planting them in the same place every other year. What is the best mulch to use to help with blight issues? Or is mulch not the answer? I know tomatoes love warm soil, and the mulch won't let the sun warm the soil as much.
Yeah, so there's different types of mulches you can use. Generally, people will use plastic mulches, black plastic, because that'll really warm up the soil. You could also use barrier fabric, which you can reuse every year. You can use wood chips and other common mulches like that. You might not get as much of a warming effect as you would with the black plastic. But generally with blight, the best way to try to avoid getting blight is just to keep your area clean below your tomatoes. A lot of times what happens is if it rains, then you might have the spores kind of splash back up on the tomato plant there is soil exposed on the bottom. So just keeping everything as sanitary and clean as possible.
Do you mean by keeping things sanitary and clean when you're talking about outside in a garden?
Yeah. So, for instance, if you have like black plastic or barrier fabric, and say you prune some leaves, or some leaves fell off, or anything kind of got below the plant, really just making sure you clean all of that out and don't leave any dead leaves or anything below your plant. Because it can expose your plant to different spores that can cause blight. And so it's funny, you don't think about sanitation in vegetable gardens, but it's probably the number one thing you can do to avoid disease and pests in a lot of ways.
It's just pick up any dead leaves and anything else that might get into your garden.
Yeah, any like rotten fruit would be another example. Keeping the area clean, if you're making sure you're, especially with tomatoes, a lot of times I'll make sure my hands are washed before I go out and prune leaves so that I'm not exposing anything to the plant. If you use pruners at all to cut any leaves, or making sure your pruners are clean, the blades are clean, that's something that we don't think about that much, but they can definitely protect your plant.
Susan on Facebook asks, what plants can survive in a sunny garden right next to the street that could take some salt and sand from the winter season? How many spots like this at the botanical gardens?
Yeah, well, we don't use salt, luckily, so we don't have that problem. We got lots of sand. I don't know if Susan means flowering plants or shrubs. She doesn't say.
My guess is, not being an expert, Rosa rugosa.
Yeah, those beach, you know, the Rosa rugosa, the native Virginia rose. We plant a lot of beach plum. That's a good one. There's something called, I've forgotten what the common name of it is. I'm blanking out on that one. But some of the perennials that, you know, that I find are pretty good. Things like Amsonia, they seem to be fine. False indigos, a lot of the meadow plants seem to be able to deal with the salt because it flushes, I think, partly before they really get actively growing, to try those things out. But,
We'll go to Andy in Monmouth. Hi, Andy. Go ahead.
Yes, hi, Jennifer. I just bought a house this winter, and there was no lawn, so they've just around the house, and they're going to be seeding, putting in the lawn. I'd also like to put in a vegetable garden, so I wondered if I want to put in additional topsoil where I'm putting the vegetable garden, and should I add any other amendments to the soil?
All right, Pamela, starting a vegetable garden from scratch, what's the ideal way to do it?
Well, I would say the first step is definitely to test your soil, and even if you're putting in a lawn too, to test your soil, you can. When you, I don't know if you've done a soil test before, but you can choose to have your test for specific, you know, they'll give you recommendations for specific types of gardens, like vegetable gardens or even lawns. So it's always good to kind of know your baseline and where you're starting at, rather than trying to make amendments that you might not even need to make those or add those amendments to your soil. So definitely soil tests is the starting point.
Mm-hmm. And would you recommend, if he's going to start a vegetable garden from scratch, a raised bed? And I mean, is there sort of an ideal mix? I know a lot of people have theories about what's the best mix to put into a vegetable garden.
Yeah, so I think our general recommendation is to do equal parts compost, something like peat moss, and then something that's going to aerate your soil a little bit, like vermiculite. So you can purchase already mixed soil bags at, you know, your local greenhouse, but making your own mix, especially if you're doing a pretty large raised bed, could be more affordable.
An email from Dave. I recently purchased a fig tree at the annual Fedco tree sale. I'm planning on growing it in a container and plan on keeping it in the basement during the colder months. My question is, what medium should I fill my container with?
Pick a big pot, you know, because they grow to be pretty big plants. And just use a good, you know, container mix for larger plants. If you go to the nursery and you ask them, I need a mix for a larger container, they'll give you a good one. So, you know, it's usually a soilless mix, kind of like Pamela was talking about, that's got bark and other amendments in it. We actually grow the figs in the ground here, but we have to cover them over in the wintertime.
Oh.
So we have figs that we plant and then bundle them up with kind of insulation blankets, and they survive outside. I wouldn't say they grow as big as they would in other places, but they do live.
Do you think bundling them outside is as effective as moving them in and out? Because he's talking about a basement and you're talking about a big pot. I'm thinking at some point this is going to get pretty, unless he's got an elevator to his basement, a pretty cumbersome project.
If he's got a walkout, he's good. Yeah, I think it's hard to know. You might have a better chance of actually getting figs if you do it in the pot, because that's the problem with them. They do get killed back and we don't get a lot of figs on them that way. But it's, if Dave, if you get kind of tired after a while of carrying that pot around, try putting it in the ground. Another thing that the old Italian gardeners back where I used to grow up would do, they'd bend the stems down and pin them to the ground and then put hay over them for the wintertime. And then they'd rake the hay off and pop the stems back up again.
Wow. Guess what? We have to take another break. Before we do so, a word about tomorrow's program. How well has America helped to sustain peace in the world? That's a question being asked and partially answered by diplomat Rick Barton. His new book, Peaceworks, America's Role in the Turbulent World. He'll be on the program tomorrow. If you have questions or comments, go ahead and email them or post them ahead of time. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
President Trump wants to keep most transgender people out of the U.S. military. Nicholas Talbot wants to serve.
My purpose is to put on that uniform and do my job and serve my country. That's what it's all about. It's not about what you look like under that uniform.
As his legal challenge to the ban moves through the courts, he preps for boot camp. A transgender recruit this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. And join us at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling for Speaking in Maine. We'll head to Orno in the University of Maine for the Stephen E. King Chair in Literature Lecture Series. Boston Globe Spotlight editor and Pulitzer Prize nominee Patricia Wen speaks on Getting It Right, Investigative Journalism in a Post-Truth Age. That's Speaking in Maine coming up after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Spring Gardening Advice. My guests are two experts, Bill Kalina with Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens and Pamela Hargest with UMaine Cooperative Extension. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. An email from Sharon. I have a hillside rock garden that has a few shrubs, bulb flowers, and perennial flowers. Despite mulching heavily with dark bark mulch 1 year, then using cardboard and newspaper with dark bark mulch on top of that, I still get little fern-like weeds that take over. I can't get rid of them. Any suggestions? Bill, you probably know the Latin name for those fern-like weeds, right?
I'm guessing it's Equisetum hymali.
I knew it.
The horsetail, you know, the scouring rush, those little things. If it looks like, Sharon, if it looks like a miniature tree or something like coming out, they're very, very difficult to get rid of. It sounds like the kind of habitat that it's a native plant, at one time, the horsetails actually were the dominant land plants, you know, and grew to tree size. But now they're just sort of these small things. So they've been around a long time, and they figured out how to survive. Really, the only way that you can get them out is every time you see one coming up, just pull it out. If that's truly what it is. If it's other types of ferns, that same thing would work too. But it just requires relentless effort to keep picking out every time you see one poking up.
Mm. We'll go to Jordan calling from Wilton. Hi, Jordan. Go ahead.
Hi. Excellent show. Thank you so much. I've got my high tunnel already, great soil in it, and I started seedlings, hot peppers, okra, and tomatoes just about a month ago. So they want to be planted now. Can I plant into this unheated high tunnel, which will be 100 degrees during the day but get quite cold at night?
Yeah, I would say so. Usually you can plant tomatoes, peppers, all those heat-loving plants in high tunnels around the beginning of May. If you're worried about nighttime temperatures coming up, you can always, you know, delay it a week or so. But, yeah, usually as early as May 1st is a good time to plant in the high tunnels.
Good luck, Jordan. Yep. We'll go to Barry, who's calling from Penobscot. Hi, Barry. Go ahead.
Hi, I want to revisit the grub issue. I've been doing some research on that, and one of the things I've read is that ducks are great for eliminating grubs, and I'd like to hear your panelists reply to that.
I haven't heard specifically of ducks, but I think generally birds are great at picking out grubs. I hear a lot of people talk about crows being in their yard eating their grubs. So it doesn't hurt if you have some kind of bird or waterfowl. Yeah, that could only help.
If you try that experiment, Barry, you got to call back and let us know how it works, because it sounds like an interesting one.
Good luck, Barry. And yeah, I have seen crows in my yard. Patricia writes to you, Bill, the monofilament fence works for deer. I've used it for 2 years now and no issues.
It's so easy. Thank you, Patricia. Yeah, I saw a YouTube video on that. I thought, this sounds like the thing for me. So
we have an email from Jan. How can I get rid of large wild rose bushes?
Probably it's the multiflora rose, which is, they're not easy to get rid of, but they're easier than some of the invasive things. Without resorting to chemicals, you have to just, you have to get out the crowns, just like any rose. And so, first cut it back so you can get in there and work at it. And then with a grub axe or something like that, take out the crown itself. If you've got a large property, people with large properties and they've got a lot of multiflora in it will, sometimes resort to using the herbicides on it in the fall, like cutting it back and painting the stumps with the concentrate. But if it's just a few of them, they're not that hard to dig out. The roots aren't that extensive unless there's a giant one.
Okay. An email from Chris. I live in Portland, and I'm limited with yard space, and I would like to do some container vegetable gardening this year. Can you discuss what types of containers and watering systems are best for vegetable gardening from lettuce up to tomatoes?
Yeah, so the bigger the plant, like tomatoes, you're going to definitely need more space. So for tomatoes, something like the size of a compound bucket would be how much space you would need for one tomato. Lettuces, they don't need as much soil, so you could plant that in a more shallow container. And it really depends on how many containers you plan on having, whether it's worth it to invest in a little irrigation as well. Being in containers and not having the ground that the plants can pull water from, they're going to probably dry out a little quicker, especially if they're not in like a plastic container, which will hold that moisture in better. So that is something to consider, is how often you're going to have to water them. There are little kind of drip irrigation lines you could run if they're all close to each other. But it depends on how much you want to invest in your garden.
Susan on Facebook writes, what is the recommended procedure for moving big geraniums outside after wintering over inside? Is there a temperature threshold? Should they be out of the sun initially? My plants are vigorous and years old, so I don't want them to suffer setbacks. I have the same question, Susan. I have geraniums. I'm eager to get outside.
Geraniums are remarkably cold tolerant if they're used to it. I mean, in the fall, you can leave them out and they can take 27, 28 degrees and they don't suffer at all. But because they've been inside, they're going to be tender. So I wouldn't move them out. I would say wait till Memorial Day and then bring them out. And definitely, you're probably going to get some leaf burn when they come out if you put them in full sun, because those leaves aren't going to be acclimated to it. But if once a leaf comes out, it can't really change. And so those leaves are probably going to get burned up anyway. I wouldn't worry too much about that. Just put them somewhere where it's, where they get some full sun, give them some fertilizer, and they'll put out lots of new foliage and be good to go.
Would you cut them back when you take them outside?
I don't think I'd cut them back at the same time. Cutting them back and then adjusting, if they're old plants that mean a lot. I probably would myself, because I can be kind of ruthless about those things. But I think if she doesn't really want to harm the shape or anything like that, just to leave them. And the time to cut them back would be if you're bringing them in the fall, definitely, and cut them back when you bring them inside.
All right. Thanks so much. This is an email from Aaron. Last year, I bought two citrus trees at a local garden center. One is a Meyer lemon and the other is a lime. They're both in about 2 gallon pots. They survived the winter and the lemon is blooming, but now the leaves are starting to fall off and there is some fiber that looks like cobwebs on the branches. I've looked and I don't see anything that looks like aphids. I'm hoping for some advice about what to do. Should I take them outside, fertilize, wash the leaves with soap and water?
It sounds like the things that they get indoors, they get mealy bugs a lot, but they look more like little cotton balls, and you get a lot of honeydew. And then they also get spider mites, which sounds like maybe what she's got, where they actually have webbing on the leaves. Both of those, the soapy water trick will help get rid of those. So certainly, like, you know, taking them out, washing them. And then if they're outside for the summer, the higher humidity and the natural pest control out there should sort of take care of it. So I think just, again, wait, you know, wait another couple of weeks, take them to the bathtub, give them a good shower, and then bring them outside, and they should perk up.
All right. Good luck, Aaron. We will go to Liz calling from Portland. Hi, Liz. Go ahead.
Hi. I had a question about bittersweet. There's a huge infestation at a place that I'm at, and it's just heinous to dig up. Is there any other way to do it besides using nasty pesticides?
We get this question every show. Bittersweet is the bane of Maine gardeners.
It's a nasty plant, Liz. And unfortunately, if you cut bittersweet back, it gets mad and it comes back even worse, you know. And so it's one of those, it is one of those things that I do. I hate using like triclopyr and Roundup and that sort of thing. But that, you know, a little bit of that, if you do it in the fall and cut the vines and then paint the wound with a little bit of the concentrate, brush be gone, it pretty much wipes them out. So the only other way you can do it is just rip up all the roots and all those sort of shallow roots that it has in there. Because cutting it back, then it comes up from those roots as all these little tiny stems that are very difficult to really get out.
All right. Good luck, Liz. I'm going to go to Tom calling from Bangor. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I have a small garden. There was a honeysuckle bush that was quite a big bush. I cut it back, covered the bush with rocks, but the root system is big enough so that the honeysuckle keeps coming back. I want to kill the honeysuckle, but leave the stuff around it. Is there a way to do that? And I'm not averse to using a little bit of Roundup if I have to.
Bill's nodding.
Well, it's kind of the same answer, I think, yeah. Tom, as with the bittersweet. I mean, if you have to resort to chemicals, the sort of the least, I think, least amount that you have to use is by actually cutting the stems and then painting it on the wound. If you cut it back, that gets a little bit harder to do, but you could just, you know, you could use it on the, just as the foliage is coming out in the spring, and spray it with just the regular, you know, like you'd get for killing weeds in your driveway. You could try doing something like putting a, heavy black trash bag over it and seeing if you can just kind of suffocate, you know, that without, it's going to look ugly. Maybe you'd have to put a face on it or make it part of garden art or something like that. But that would be, you know, another thing to think about. Something like
All
that.
Right. Good luck, Tom. We have another Tom calling from Lewiston. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My advice was on tomatoes. When you plant your tomatoes, there's a thing called an automator, which is a 16-inch square thing, black, which gives heat to the plant. And also, when I planted my tomatoes and other crops, I would use a solution of Epsom salts, which you mix 1 pound per gallon of water, and then you put 8 ounces in a cup on each plant as you plant it. What that does is help them foliage up and protect them. And you'll get tomatoes about 10 days earlier than anybody else.
Have you heard about these, Pamela, these tricks?
I actually haven't, but I'm not too surprised by the Epsom salt, because I know that Epsom salt usually can help when you have blossom end rot. It allows your tomato plant to take up more calcium sometimes. So sometimes you apply it to like the bottom of the plant. So maybe that tomato is just getting a lot more nutrients right away.
What was the name, Tom, of that thing?
The automator?
Automator.
Is it electric? Is it a little heat source?
No, it's a plastic thing that you put on the ground. It's got four tabs that allow the water to go down to the roots of the plant. It holds about a quart of liquid, and it's black. And it's plastic.
Okay.
And what that does is add heat, and also puts it, when you water it, water goes directly to the plant.
All right.
I used to use it for my watermelons and cantaloupe, and I get 20-pound watermelons with them.
Yum. Excellent. Well, Tom, thanks for calling with your tip. We're going to go to Patty, an email What is the best way to manage voles in the flower and vegetable garden? Do the ultrasonic units work? Signed, Desperate in Phippsburg.
Oh, man. Well, I'm not sure about the what was that, ultrasonic?
Ultrasonic units. Have you heard about these, either of you?
Have you heard about them?
I've not tried them. Some people said that they find that they do work. Others say they don't. It's hard. You have to kind of do some kind of control test to really see. But some people, that I've talked to that have come in and, chatted say that they think it helps drive them away.
Yeah. What do you recommend for voles in the community gardens that you are involved with?
That's tough. I mean, I think looking at small pests like that, it's looking at where those animals might be, where their habitat might be. So, especially with something like groundhogs and sometimes with voles, if there is a shelter area, like a lot of times community gardens might have a little shed or something where an animal can take shelter in the rain or they can have their nest there. Usually I would recommend to eliminate any places like that on your community garden that could cause that problem.
Yeah, rock walls, compost piles. For the perennials and everything, we cut things back in the fall. That takes away the cover because they're worried about hawks and other, other things mm-hmm. seeing them. So when we have a lot of snow in the wintertime, then they can get underneath. But certainly the place that I have the most voles is in the compost pile. So I keep that far away from the garden.
All right. I think that's our last question today. Before we go, I know that you all want to put in a plug for local nurseries. Bill, why is it so important to shop at a local nursery and as opposed to some of the other options available to gardeners?
The local family-owned nurseries, you're going to get, you're going to get quality plants, but you're going to get people that really have the experience to know, what to plant and when and what works in Maine. And it really is supporting an important industry in the state. So shop local, get out there and plant something.
Well, thank you both for being here. We're going to invite you back a few more times this summer because we know this is just the beginning of the questions. That was Bill Kalina, the president and CEO of Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. Also here, Pamela Hargest, a horticulture professional with the University of Maine's Cooperative Extension in Cumberland County. John Keimel ran the board today. You can always find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a whole bunch of information about programs at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Working for Peace in a Turbulent World. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.